is the fourth day of our seven-day Seven Dharma 2010. Retreat. Just before we return to Vimalakirti, there are just two quick questions. Somebody had a question about the meaning of the han. The han is the wooden block that is struck out there. Again, it is one of those meaningless things that occur in Zen monasteries. It is just, you know, like the bell in a Zen monastery, different kind of monastery, different kinds of bells. It's just a it's a sound. Maybe that's the best way to put it. It is a sound that is used, again, to either accentuate or to you know, have a certain meaning in terms of some event. My sense of a han, it's a very clear sound. Whap, you know. And so, like many of these sounds, they are a help. Because when you hear that that sound of whap, you know, it can drive all thoughts out of your mind and bring you to very clear attention. So it is, and the reason we invite it from the time the 10-minute warning bell until we sit down is just to help the practitioners. Who are the practitioners? You and I. So from that moment, if we haven't up to that point from hearing that bell until we arrive in the meditation hall, we have something to remind us to let go of thoughts and to be present. So that's its function. There's also a question about in group walking meditation, are we supposed to stay evenly spaced with the person in front of us as opposed to walking at our own pace? And yes, when we're walking individually, obviously we have opportunity to walk at any pace we want. But when walking as a group, we are walking as a group, and we sort of like in the gata that was just read, going as an organism, going like a river. We just flow along. We let go of how we like to do things, or how we think things should be done, or what's comfortable to us, or whatever, and we just let go. Right? Like the third patriarch says, not picking or choosing. Many people, when they hear things like that, they get a little freaked out. Because they think their freedom comes from their freedom to pick and choose. So it's interesting the third patriarch calls picking and choosing the disease of the mind. Right. Disease. Ease. Causes disease of the mind. And he says the freedom is not to be free to pick and choose whatever you want, because that's always or mostly driven by ego, likes and dislikes, wants and needs, and you know, all the expectations, the whole elaborate structure that self created to give ourselves identity. Right? I'm somebody who walks this way and not somebody who walks that way. As if in the realm of truth, there is a right and wrong way of walking. These things are merely relative. And so we want true freedom comes from to be able to be free in the world of picking and choosing. It doesn't mean I never pick and choose, because obviously be in life is always to be picking and choosing, unless you're in a very highly disciplined environment where everything is, you know, you're told what to do, probably something like the military or something. But for those of us in civilian life, life is a lot about picking and choosing. But we don't have to pick and choose with a sense of right or wrong. Because when there's a sense of right or wrong, there's no freedom in that, good or bad. walk this way, I don't walk that way. I only eat this, I don't eat that. I only wear this color, I don't wear that color. If we have the opportunity to choose what we wear, that's fine. But if for some reason we can't wear the things we like to wear, we'll wear something else. They're just things. They have no meaning of themselves. So anyhow, it's a long-winded answer. So anyhow, yes, we do walk.
Does that include Sam's walk?
Yeah, I mean, actually, over these next days, there's going to be a lot more solitary time and freer time. But I guess when the community decides to go as a walk up to the knoll, we walk together. And again, as I sort of said yesterday after Zoe's remarks, this is retreat. This is a Dharma retreat. And we are here, I mean, we are here to nourish ourselves, to enjoy ourselves, but we're primarily here to wake up, right? And we want to take this opportunity to look at the very source of our delusion, which unfortunately is none other than our own minds, right? So what that means is whenever we bump up against resistance, you know, I want to walk, I don't want to go with a group, right? I don't like the pace that Sam set it. I want to be by myself, and I want to walk the way I want to walk, right? Anybody know that part of themselves? we all know that part of ourselves. And it comes out in different ways, in different situations, depending on who we are and how we function. But at that moment, we look at that. Because who's out? Self is out, right? It's going center stage and saying, I want to do it my way, right? So at that moment is a wonderful time to practice, because a lot of time self is more subtle, and self is more background, kind of more suffuses our actions, you know what I'm saying, but when he or she is out, you know, like, I want to do it this way, I don't want to do it that way, then it's self is very strong, right? It's very clear. And if you're a practitioner of Dharma, you go, wonderful, right? This is great, you know? That's why when people come to me and they say, I'm really pissed at this, or my response is, great. You know, this is a wonderful time because he's out, right? You know, taking the gloves off. You know, taking all the nice mask off. You know, he's out and pissed. You know, or wanting blood. Right? Great. You know what I mean? If you're a practitioner, you stop. You step back and you look. What is this? You just kind of step over to the side. You look. There are many ways, we'll talk about that actually in Mukherjee today, there are many ways then to dissemble this apparently real-looking thing. It takes itself very seriously, believes it's real. So again, we're on retreat, and so all those times when we bump up again individuals, when we bump up again the schedule, when we bump up against anything that we want to push back at, right? Or that we want to get away from, this is the time to practice. Right? Is that clear? So for those of you who have very strong egos and just keeps popping up all the time, you're in luck. You've come to the right place. And you're really ahead, you know, all those people who have much more selfless and egoless, they have a much harder time practicing. But somebody like you, you know, you'll become enlightened quite quickly, because you have a very strong self that can be very easily seen. Okay. So count yourself one of the lucky ones.
you know, in ancient times, and probably still in Buddhist countries up to today, it was very common that meditators would go to scary places, such as a graveyard, a cremation ground, etc. You know, or just, you know, be alone in the jungle, be alone in the forest where there are all kinds of animals and stuff like that. Why? Because it's scary. And when you're scared, self is very much, again, out. So that's why often, there, you know, especially in cultures that believe in spirits, spirits of the dead, believe in ghosts, you know, these types of places, again, cremation grounds and graveyards were places, you know, you didn't go after dark because all kinds of bad things were there. And so a lot of fright, a lot of terror. But obviously, again, when you know when you're scared, there's a self that's behind all that. So oftentimes that's where they would practice specifically for that reason, because it was a scary place and because self was very scared and therefore so easier to see it. It's like that. So, if you have a big ego, a very strong ego, don't despair. If you just have to be willing to see it and to name it and then to look deeply into it. That's all. So, if you remember from yesterday, Vimalakirti and Manjushri are talking about sickness, and you know, a very human kind of thing. You know, what do you do when you're visiting somebody who's sick? What do you say to them? So, if you remember yesterday, we ended with Vimalakirti saying, so this is how a bodhisattva should comfort, instruct a bodhisattva who is ill so as to make him or her feel happy. So then Manjushri said, layman, how should a bodhisattva who is ill go about tempering and controlling her mind? Now it's about if you find yourself sick, how should you control your mind? And Vimalakirti replied, a bodhisattva who is ill should think to him or herself, now these illnesses of mine all spring from the deluded thoughts, the upside down thinking, and various earthly desires of my past existence. They have no real existence. So who is it who suffers illness? Why? The four major elements come together, and therefore we apply a makeshift name, calling the thing a body. But the four major elements have no master, and the body has no I or ego. And these illnesses all arise from attachment to ego. Therefore, I should harbor no such attachment to ego. So is that clear? It's kind of straightforward. Now, again, we have to understand here that when he says that now these illnesses of mine all spring from the deluded thoughts, from upside-down thinking and various earthly desires of my past existences. So in traditional Buddhist thinking, there is this you know, belief in lives, right? Countless, countless, endless lives. And what is it that propels us toward taking a body? It is our attachments, our delusions, our desires that keep us moving forward in this chain of incarnation into a body. So not only are all those things the the moving force in our endlessly taking body, they also form the variables which kind of create the kind of body we have, and therefore have a direct relationship to the kinds of things our body may be experiencing internally. As was said yesterday, modern science sees things somewhat differently about the causes of disease, but also, as it was said the other day, it's interesting that medical science is more and more beginning to understand that there is somewhat too strong relationship of mind states to physicality. To think that the mind and the mind states actually have something to do with the actual formation of the body is probably a leap, but just to understand at least quite strongly the mind state. And when we're talking about that, we're not only talking about psychosomatic kind of illnesses where one sees a direct relationship between a mind state and some sort of illness or disease entity. There's also research in terms of things like immune systems and things like that, which show that a mind state has to do with the general well-being of a body, the general resistance to disease of a body. We don't have to buy the whole package here of past lives and that the mind states and everything from our past lives are the contributor to how things are manifesting in our body. But certainly to see there is a causal relationship, and that mind and mind states may be a much more powerful variable in the creation of illness and disease than believed up to now. Again, I'm not a physician. I don't know, but we know that even where people are catching viruses and things like that. Not everybody catches them, right? I mean, you can have many people who are exposed to the same, but not everybody catches them. So we know there are variables here. The obvious variable that Vimalakirti seems to be positing is that somebody whose mind is totally free of greed, anger, all the hindrances, totally free of any clinging or attachment to self or other, and whose mind is totally spacious and free and is only filled with loving kindness and compassion, that person will have good health. should be generally a healthy person. I don't know if there are enough Buddhas around these days that we can actually do a test, set up some kind of experiment or something to see if that factors out, but maybe one day Jun will do that kind of test or us do some research, figure that out, if that's really the case. Either way, if we don't purely take illness in just a dichotomy of body, but see that when we're talking about illness, we're talking about illness of body-mind, then I think we can very clearly see how our mind states of fear, anxiety, sadness, despair, right? Anger, resentment, right? All these kinds of mind states, impatience, all the strong emotions certainly affect us. Not simply do they affect us, when we're in them, but they affect us often long afterwards and affect our relationships, right? And have a direct effect on how our bodies feel. So again, now these illnesses of mine all spring from the deluded thoughts, the upside-down thinking, and various earthly desires of my past existence. They have no real existence, so who is it who suffers illness? So those you know that in our tradition, the Zen tradition and the Dzogchen tradition, a fundamental question is, who am I? What am I? What is this? Right? This looking at that which thinks it is suffering. You know, I am sick. How are you? I am sick. Right? There is an I that claims to be sick. Right? That is the way we communicate with each other, and that is the way we state things. Now, there's obviously, when one is sick, there's obviously certain kinds of experiences or symptomologies that are going on in the body, right? Martina yesterday, I don't know how she's doing today, but when she, you know, there obviously we could see her eye, her runny nose, I mean, hear her breathing. There were obvious symptoms that we would label as sick, right? But whether there was a Martina who was sick, right? That's what we are being told to investigate. Who is it that says they're sick? The four major elements come together. And you know, in traditional Asian, you know, the four elements are air, earth, water, and fire. And so they believe, I mean, people who practice Asian forms of medicine, you know, what's called Chinese medicine or Ayurvedic medicine or different kinds of traditional medicines, still to this day use that as a kind of a diagnostic basis, that these four elements are coming together and need to be in balance and harmony, and et cetera, et cetera. But basically that's kind of what they're talking about here. So the four elements come together, right? So they might say, again, I'm not a, somebody correct me, but in other words, you know, we have material form in our body, we have liquid in our body, we have heat in our body, and obviously we have air in our body. You know, so these are the four elements, we could say, that you know, the four elements, the material stuff, that are put together to make up our body. Right. So they say these four elements, they come together in a physical body, and then we apply a makeshift name. We kind of make up a name. And we call the thing what? A body. Right? So these four elements have come together, and we call these things a body. Steel and plastic has come together in a certain form, and we call this what? And we give it a makeshift name, and we call it what? A thermos. And then we call, and a bunch of plastic and electric parts have come together, and we call this a? An iPhone. See, we don't even know what to call it. But of course, whether we call it an iPod or an iPhone, it's still the same. Right? This is still this. So we make up these names, and we call this a flower, and we go over there, and we call that bunch of elements. We call that Bill, and a bunch of elements. We call that Angie, right? And there's a bunch of elements back there. We call Alex, and it's like that. Right, way back there, a bunch of four elements together, Robbie, and she's got this thing wrapped around her that we call something too. Right? So we're endlessly, you know, just going around making up names for things. Right? But the four major elements have no master. This is the key thing. But the four major elements have no master, and the body has no I, or ego. And as you know, you've heard me teach before, and you know, what we say, this is called the twofold emptiness. The emptiness of things and the emptiness of self. Right?
The microphone has a mouth.
The microphone has a mouth. Thank you. But the four major elements, Alex, have no master. So what does that mean? So it means that we'll take Ken over here. He's a big guy, easily seen. So, you know, we can see when we look at Ken, right? We can see the elements, can't we? I mean, we can see his bodily form and, you know, I mean, we can imagine the other stuff. that have all come together to create a body and that functions in a certain way. But then we also say there's also, beside all those elements in there working together, we say what? There's also a Ken. There's somebody who owns all that, runs all that, or as is said here, is the master of all that, right? That is what we say. And the question is, what they say here, they say, that's not true. So they don't even ask the question. They say here, it's a sutra, they say, that's not true. Because if we look deeply into Ken, we can find all the four elements. We can find the element of solidity. We can find the element of liquid. We can find the element of air, and we can find the element of heat, fire, but we cannot find anything called Ken. Right? It's made up. And the same way, I forget how this develops now, we can take what is expressed in the Heart Sutra and throughout Buddhism, which is the skandhas, the five skandhas are empty. Five skandhas of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, right? And we can put those together like building blocks to put together this. But if we take that all apart, we will not find a Ken. We will not find a Ken, and that's what it says in the Heart Sutra, right? They're all empty. You know, in the Heart Sutra it said the skandhas are empty, the five skandhas are empty. It means they're empty of self. They're empty of identity. They're empty of any kind of permanent. So that's the deal. The four major elements have no master, and the body has no I or ego. And these illnesses all arise because we're attached to the ego. Right? So here's this fundamental misperception. Right? A delusion. Right? Misperception means what? We don't perceive things as they are. Delusion means what? We have an irrational belief that we think is true. Right? So that's why in Buddhism, belief in a separate self is called a delusion, a misperception. It is called ignorance. Right? Ignorance means what? Somebody's ignorance is what? Doesn't understand what's true, is ignorant, doesn't get it, doesn't get the way things really are, right? So anyhow, it goes on to say, therefore, this again, Vimalakirti saying about the person who's sick, therefore the person who's sick should harbor no such attachment to ego, right? So there are two things, and it gets very interesting here. Is everybody staying with me? So there are two things that go on here. One is this fundamental misperception that we perceive there's an I there, right? But then what goes on is we attach to the I, right? And from our attachment to the I grows the melodrama, right? Of self and other. Right? And all the needs and everything that people have shared in... everything people have shared in deep sharing, so much of the emotional stuff and the difficulties we having the insights, so much we share in our personal interviews, and so much we've been sharing, you know, dealing with our whole life, is from that problem. Get rid of that problem, you've gotten rid of a ton of problems in your life. That's why in Zen, Dzogchen, we say go to the root of the problem if you want to be free. Cut down the tree. The tree's in the way. Don't keep, you know, going out every day and snipping off a few leaves. Cut it down. Be nice to go up to the knoll and cut down some trees, right? Get a wider view. Just like that, right? Things are blocking our view of the mountains. Well, things are blocking our view of reality. And all we're doing is that kind of, we're just like, rearranging the furniture on the Titanic, right, or something like that. Rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic or something like that, you know. Yeah. Therefore, I should harbor no such attachment to ego. Again, you know, like we said, I think, earlier in this retreat, the tools in Buddhism are understanding. We don't have to destroy the ego. We don't have to hate the ego. We don't have to be disgusted by the ego. And again, that's where a lot of us get to. We're frustrated with ourselves. We're angry with ourselves. We're disgusted by our ego's interest. You know what I mean? We get like that. We're weary of it. See clearly into it. See it for what it is. What is it, Ken? It's a delusion. It's not real. No such thing has ever existed. Except where? In our imagination. And because we believe, like, you know, children with their imaginary friends. It's like we've, Bill has an imaginary friend. He created him his little called Bill. Ken has his imaginary friend. He calls Ken. Years later, he's still imagining Ken and Bill are still with him. Right? I mean, that's nice. That you have a close friend like that. but he's not real. He's just an imaginary friend. It's like that. So again, when people are sharing about their needs, to be liked, their needs, to feel worthy, their needs to be loved, their needs to be noticed, their needs, you know, all those needs. Those are needs of your imaginary friend. You don't need any. You're all, you know, as it said, the Buddha said, each one of us is whole and complete just the way we are. We don't need anything. When you don't need anything, everything and anything that comes your way is fine. You can take it or leave it. You're free. But as long as you are living through your imaginary friend, as long as you're attached, the key thing is attached, right? Therefore, I should harbor no such attachment to ego. This is the core of Dharma. Practices of mindfulness, the practices of concentration, they're just the setting. But this is the jewel that sits in the setting. Because this is the liberation. When we are no longer attached to the endless needs and wants and machinations of self. And we see clearly who and what it is. And therefore we see the same thing in others as well. Then life is much easier. So Vimalakirti goes on. Once one has understood the origins of illness, one may do away with the thought of an I or ego and the thought of other living beings. The thought of other living beings. So again, very fundamental to this tradition. Thinking, dualistic thinking, is a disease of the mind. When Bill was saying yesterday the phrase in the Dzogchen tradition that it's the mind, that all the thoughts, feelings, perceptions of the mind are the magical display of the Buddha. It's like that. Magical display means what? It's like fireworks. Fireworks is a magical display. Right? It's quite wonderful to watch. But there's no permanence or reality into it. It's just temporary. But it's a magical, wonderful display. We enjoy fireworks, right? But we don't go up there in the sky and try to grab one of them, do we? Because what'll happen if we attach to a firework? Right? A magical display is what? To be enjoyed. To watch. But not too attached. Our minds are incredible, right? Our imagination is incredible. The things that, you know, you sit here, you watch your mind, it just one minute after, it just throws up one magical display after another. Right? That's all it is. Just learn to watch it. Happy magical displays, sad magical displays, you know, endlessly displays. That's all it is, a display. You watch the fireworks, right? Comes. Beautiful. Psh, disappears. Like the fireflies. Same way with thoughts. Why is it we can go out there and watch fireflies, right? And not have a problem? But we can't watch our own mind with the same sense of wonder and detachment. Just enjoy it. Don't follow it. Right? I mean, I don't know, it's a little dark out there at night, but I see a number of you out there. I don't really know who you are, but I see these forms, little lights going around. but I've noticed that most people are quite content sort of to stay on the road. Turn off your lights and watch the fireflies. I don't hear anybody crashing about in the woods, you know, trying to grab them. Right? You laugh because what? One, that would be dangerous, and two, it's absurd. I mean, we're quite content, what? Just to watch them. We don't need to go get one for ourselves. And yet, in this magical display of our mind, of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, we're just constantly grabbing. poison ivy, poison oak out there. Danger in grabbing those thoughts, attaching. Once one has understood the origins of illness, one may do away with the thought of an I or an ego and the thought of other living beings. Right. So not only is in one's meditation, is one introspecting into the nature of one's own mind and self, but one is also, just like we just did earlier, continually deconstructing the thought that this is also a separate, self-existent person. Each one of us is a mystery, right? Is there anybody here who would say, I totally understand myself completely? And I know one thought from another and why they arise one after the other just the way they do, and I understand every reaction I make, and is there anybody here? No. The truth is what? We're a complete mystery to ourselves. The more we study ourselves, the more mysterious and absurd the whole thing becomes, right? And yet we think we know everybody else. You know, we get the number in everybody else. She's a so-and-so, he's a so-and-so, you know? We can only do that when we label. We put labels, we put words, we put, you know, it's not real. And it takes all the joy out of life, takes all the naturalness and spontaneity out of life. Because what we do is we, you know, in our labeling, we are pigeonholing, quantifying, you know. It's our way of controlling the universe. I get the number on everybody. And we don't have the slightest idea even who we are. Once what is understood the origin of illness, one may do away with such thought of an I or ego and the thought of other living beings. To do so, this is Vimalakirti continuing, to do so one should call up the thought of phenomena. So now he's given us actually a practice. Okay? To do so one should call up the thought of phenomena, thinking to oneself. So phenomena means what? A thing. Anything in Buddhism, the actual word is dharmas with a small d. The dharmas means a thing, a phenomenon. Everything is a phenomenon. Even thoughts, feelings, perceptions, you know, anything that can be named is a thing. Right? So when you say phenomena, you're really going everything in the world of form, in the world of non-form, everything. So one should call up the, you know, anything, think about phenomena, and then think to oneself. We're dealing with the body. It is simply the various phenomena that have come together to form this body. It has appeared simply because phenomena appeared, and it will vanish simply because phenomena vanish. All these phenomena are none of them known to one another. When they appear, they do not say, I have appeared. And when they vanish, they do not say, I have vanished. I mean, it's very interesting, isn't it? So, taking our model up here, or cadaver, we could say he is, you know, a bunch of phenomena came together, right? All kinds of, and it's interesting. But it came together quite small in the beginning, and then kind of grew. But actually the seeds of the complexity were always there. So we have at this point, what? A collection of lots and lots of phenomena, right? Big phenomena, little phenomena, phenomena within phenomena, things within things within things within things, all interrelating, working together. Right? So what it's saying, when all this phenomena comes together, each one, there's no identity in any of them that they announce, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, the liver didn't announce to the kidneys, I'm here. Can you go, oh, good to see you. You know, how are you? It's been a long time, you know, right? None of that. They just manifested. And phenomena just manifested according to causes and condition. Right? And at some point, all that phenomena that is in relation to the other, beginning, just like all the body parts, all the different organs and muscle groups and et cetera, all the various, we'll say, larger phenomena of the body that have come together, at some point will leave. And they won't say goodbye to each other. There's no personality or self involved, is it? So all we see here is phenomena coming together, of which mind, mental events, thoughts, feelings, memory, are just another kind of mental phenomena. That's all it is. And Ken is simply a convenient label that Ken's parents gave to that. And when they gave it to that, it didn't even look like that. Actually. You know, if it had come out of his mother looking like that, God knows what they would have called it. Right? But because it was little, kind of tiny and cute, at least in his mother's eyes, right? They said, "Well, let's call him Kenneth." Did they call you Kenneth? Let's call it Kenneth. That's all. They named that collection of phenomena Kenneth. And then it was just like this big. You know, and it couldn't do anything. It was totally helpless, incapable. Right? And they called it Kenneth. And for some bizarre reason, you know, it's gotten big and this and that. And we still call it by its same name, as if it's the same thing as that baby. Scientific wonder. It is simply that various phenomena have come together to form this body. It has appeared simply because phenomena appeared, and it will vanish simply because phenomena vanish. It is the nature of phenomena to vanish. Right? It's the nature of phenomena according to cause and conditions, to come together in various ways, and eventually it is the nature of phenomena to disappear. That is just the way it is. And that law of phenomena relates to us, to the phenomena that make us up. Okay? When they appear, they do not say, "I have appeared." And when they vanish, they do not say, "I have vanished." They are simply phenomena. And then Vimalakirti continues. Then, he's again, this is his instruction. So first we call together some phenomena and look deeply into it, and see the causes that bring it together, the causes that will cause it to vanish, and the cause and conditions that create both. There is no personality in any of it again. There's no saying, "I have appeared," and there's no saying, "I have vanished." No different than this thermos, right? The thermos, you know, when I took the cup off and I brought over here, you know, the thermos didn't say to the cup, "Where are you going? Where are you going? Or what did he do to my head?" Right? Right? It wasn't like that one. The thermos understood that it's just phenomena. Just change. Then, in order to wipe out the thought of phenomena, the ailing bodhisattva should think to herself, "This thought or concept of phenomena, too, is a form of upside-down thinking. And upside-down thinking can lead to great misfortune. Okay? So we've been thinking about how all these various kinds of phenomena have come together to create that we know is labeled such and such, but or you know, or whatever, but we know there, even though it is a label just means it's a name so we can call it something, right? So when dinner time was there, you know, they wanted to make sure that he came, so they said, "Ken, come to dinner." That's why they named him Ken. They had to name him something, right? They had no choice, or especially if he had any brothers and sisters, it would be confusing. That's why they called him Ken. Right? It was just convenient. Or else what are you going to do with a child if you don't give him a name? How can you call them? Right? And he goes to school, he needed to be told what seat. So it was a convenience to name that collection of phenomena, to give it a name. Okay? That's all that there is. All right, so now that we've thought about phenomena, he's saying now even having a concept of phenomena, too, is a form of upside-down thinking that can lead to misfortune. I must rid myself of it. But how do I rid myself of it? By ridding myself of thoughts of I and mine, which means ridding myself of dualism. Dualism means what? And dualism is kind of the operating principle of what's called the relative world, because you can't, in the dualistic world, you always have to have a second thing that goes along that helps define the first, right? Right. So, floors don't exist without ceilings. Down doesn't exist without up. Everything has its opposite in the world of dualism. If we posit things to be, certain things to be good, we have to posit other things to be bad. If we say certain things are right, then there have to be, the opposite thing would be wrong. In the world of dualism, there's always a two. There's always an opposite that goes along with it. So, there is phenomena, right? But the question is, does even the phenomena exist or not exist? We know that the body of Ken doesn't exist. It is just made up of phenomena. So we might say, oh, therefore, what's real is phenomena. But he says, no, we need to look again deeper. Is there such a thing even as phenomena that exists or does not exist? What is meant by ridding oneself of dualism? It means not thinking of phenomena as external or internal, but treating all as equal. What is meant by equal? It means that I and nirvana are treated as equal. Why? Because I and nirvana are both empty. Why are they empty? Because they are mere names. Hence, empty. Neither of these two phenomena have any fixed nature or characteristics. Once one has acquired this kind of equal outlook, one will be freed of all other illnesses and will have only the illness of emptiness. And the illness of emptiness, too, is empty. Yeah. So, coming back to So we use the words internal and external, right? So we would say what? Well, I probably would say you are external to me, right? You are outside of me. Wouldn't we, most of us would say that? Look over there. There's somebody over there, external to me. And yet, I am perceiving you, right? I am seeing you. I am perceiving you. I am aware of you, right? As you are of me. Now, that which perceives you also has the capability of perceiving me. Right? I can perceive sensations. I can perceive thoughts. Right? So that capacity to be aware is the same. And for me to say that you are outside me, but other things are inside me, is really not true. Everything is appearing in awareness. And whether I am perceiving things located here, or whether I am perceiving things supposedly located there, they all are occurring in the same awareness. So when you look at me now, or you look, forgive me for having you look at me. When you just look around the room, where is your mind? Would you say, people go and say what? Oh, my mind's inside me. So what's all that? Where's that? And this awareness can go right out the door. Out the window over there. Out the window over there. Up into the sky. Right? And yet we say, oh, my mind is inside. Is that the way you experience it right now? Do you feel like your awareness is just, people go, oh, it's in my brain. One thing that drives me crazy when people talk like that. They say, you really feel like that's where your awareness is inside your head? Is that your experience? We're not talking scientific textbooks. We're talking about experience. Do you feel like your awareness is just in your head? Do you feel like your awareness just stops at your skin? Don't you experience your awareness filling up everything? Zooming around corners. Able to be up in the trees listening to the birds. Able to imagine things in the past, imagine things in the future. If you look around this room, everything is related to everything else. Right? You know, we can go around labeling everybody individually, right? But if you actually just look without thinking, the whole thing is just one thing, isn't it? It's
floor and cushions and chairs and mats and people and lamps and fans. It's all, everything is related to everything else. Everything is supporting everything else. Everything is touching everything else. It doesn't end, does it? It goes right out the door and boulders, trees, sky, clouds. Nothing exists unto itself. And that's just looking around here. We know that if we look inside, we see in the whole, the myriad mystery of our bodies. So many different cells and organisms all interrelated, working together, and, it just doesn't end. And all that's in relationship to our parents and the genetic makeup and, just water and the sun and the food and it's all the earth. Our bodies are the earth, and our bodies are the water and the streams and the rain. And you look up in the sky and you go, is there a place where it ends? It doesn't end, does it? No beginning, no end. Into your awareness. Do you remember when it began? Anybody have a clear memory before there was awareness? And then when the light went on one day?
Does awareness end with death?
According to, no. It does not end with, because according to Buddhism, everything has causes and conditions. If something was not born, it will not die. It's sort of like if you believe in God, the question of, well, where did God come from, right, can only be answered as what? Yeah, it's a mystery. You go back to a certain point, you have to go, it's always been there, right? It's just the way it is. I mean, because if you believe that there was something before God, then who created God, or where did that come from? So at some point, there has to be a beginningless beginning, right? Because it's like that. And I think in Buddhism, I think that's the only point you come to. It just appears to have no beginning. It just always is. And because we do not see that is the reality, and that our relative life here, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, the whole is taking place in this context, and we misidentify, right? Ken thought he was Ken. He always runs around labeling himself as Ken, and Bill takes very seriously how Ken's doing. Right? Is he successful? Is he unsuccessful? Is he liked? Is he not liked? Is he getting his needs met? Is he not getting his needs met? I mean, he's just built the whole thing up. All from that fundamental misperception. He thought there was somebody home. He thought there was somebody running the store. He didn't realize the story is just running itself. Thoughts coming and going, feelings coming and going. Like the fireflies. What is meant by the source of illness? It means having troublesome entanglements. Please just take a moment now and reflect on your troublesome entanglements. Is that really what's gone on in this life?
we keep getting ourselves entangled. Right. And our entanglements become troubles. Where there are troublesome entanglements, these become the source of illness. What are these troublesome entanglements tied to? They are tied to the threefold world. The threefold world in Buddhism is the world of desire, the world of form, and the world of formlessness. These are kind of the three worlds that non-Buddhic, unenlightened beings kind of circle through. The world of desire, beings who live in the world of desire, it's basically that. They're always just filled with desires, endlessly desiring things. The world of form is to live in a world where one sees forms, but are not constantly desiring them, right? And the world of formlessness is a world without form, but we could say it's more the realm of kind of abstract ideas and thoughts and things like that. So again, this world of desire, form, and formlessness is one way that this world is looked at. And obviously, if you just think about your own experience, you realize they kind of get mixed together. And one way of looking at the ensnarement of sentient beings is how ensnared are they, at the various levels. Obviously, people who are just totally, totally ensnared by constantly desiring, it's sort of like going out to a club with 20-year-olds on a Saturday night or something, it's kind of that realm. the world of desire. Right, but you understand. And the world of forms is to still be in a world of forms where we say everything is separate, but it's not so driven. Maybe that's older age or something. And then formlessness is really much more philosophical, abstract thinking, idealization, but still all ensnared within the world of form. They are tied to the threefold world. And how does one cut them off? By realizing that there is nothing to grasp at. If one ceases to grasp at anything, there will be no more troublesome entanglements. So if you want to, I know we've been kind of wandering through fairly deep, complex topics this morning. But if we want to just bring it down, if one ceases to grasp at anything, there will be no more troublesome entanglements. So if you look at your life, past, up to this moment, and see that you get entangled. You get entangled with situations, events, people, you get entangled with your own thought forms, emotions, memories, fantasies. When you notice that you have gotten entangled something and it becomes troublesome. Troublesome means what? It disturbs your equanimity. It disturbs your peace of mind. It disturbs the open, spacious quality of your mind. It disturbs your capacity to be at ease. Okay? That's troublesome. So if you find that you live a life of entanglement that becomes troublesome, Then Vimalakirti says, stop grasping. Right? If you do not get entangled, you won't get in trouble. So it doesn't get any simpler than that. It's kind of wonderful, the teaching, right? I mean, it's very profound, but there's great genius in this, right? How these guys put it together. They kind of go like, they start out here, and then they kind of bump, 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 bump. Don't grasp at anything. Is there anybody that doesn't understand that? What is your problem?
It's a very profound teaching that you sort of, I'm amazed that, you know, you've gotten as far as you have in a short period of time because you've covered so much, but it's sort of trying to grasp something like the concept of infinity. It's a word, but it's really hard to get your arms around.
Right. You can't grasp it. But again, it is not only don't grasp, but it's also don't intellectualize. You know, all the teachings come back to that. It is beyond comprehension. Beyond comprehension doesn't mean it can't be known. It's just something that cannot be known conceptually. Right? I mean, you could philosophically understand it and create a model to understand it, but that doesn't give happiness and joy and freedom. Right? Again, if it did, people would be flocking to philosophy departments of American universities if they were seeking healing and transformation. We don't do that because we understand to have a philosophical conception, even a noble one, does not necessarily create a living experience. The wonderful thing here is that this can be known if you stop thinking and just start looking.
Well, I see you up there, and I think the world's greatest theoretical physicist who calculated infinity, and he never believed it until somebody discovered black holes. And if he was alive, he would have said, wow. But he theoretically understood it, but he never believed that it could exist. Hmm. Just like that.
But before those theoretical physicists posited such a thing as infinity, we have these guys positing infinity as a living experience. And as a living experience that is available to all of us. I'm not a physicist or a scientist, so I'm sort of way out of my comfort zone here, but infinity means no end. Right? Where does this end? Look around. Where does this end? I mean, I'm an idiot. I don't see any end to this. Right? I look that way, it just goes on. I look that way, it just goes on. I look into my mind, I can't see your front or back. I can't see your beginning or end. That's infinity. It's endless and boundless. And it is our very nature. It is thought that divides it up. Again, it doesn't mean that thinking is not a useful tool. In the same way, calling him Ken is not useful if we want to call him. Or we want to send him a letter or something. You know what I mean? It's useful. It's a useful designation. That's all. But in no way has any relevance to that. That is not a ken. If that was a thing called a ken, then we could bring all the kens together in this world and it'd all be the same. Right? That name means nothing. It's just a designation. Sorry. These are all designations. I is a designation. You is a designation. They are not real. Real in any what? Self-existent sense. Things appear to be a certain way. And is only part of an investigation. That's why in Buddhism, wisdom, insight, prajna is the key thing. We have to investigate the nature of reality beyond appearances to see the truth of things. And as you keep saying, all the teachings keep saying, just look beyond the appearances, they investigate things, and you will see clearly the truth of this. And the truth of this, and the truth of the Heart Sutra, and the truth of, these are not esoteric metaphysical truths, that some far out mystic, uncovered in their alchemy, in their alchemical laboratory. This is just the nature of reality. That anybody who investigates the nature of reality, to me, that's why Buddhism is so accessible. So practical, and is available to anybody of any religious persuasion. It's because it's not a religion. It's become a religion. But the way the Buddha, if you go to the Buddha's teaching, he was just teaching a way of understanding the nature of reality and how to live a good life in relationship to that understanding. And if one wants to practice Buddhism as a religion, if one wants to practice Christianity or Judaism or Islam, or whatever, or shamanism, whatever, well, that's fine. But Buddhism goes right to the core, the heart of what it means to be a human being. For some people, that's enough. For other people, it's not. That's fine. Yes?
I'm not being theoretical here. I'm being practical. And you're saying if you investigate the nature of phenomenon, labels and everything, you see through it in the grasp essence. Do you have any other tools for not grasping? Just noticing, letting go?
Again, at this level of teaching, it is simply this is not a one-time investigation. This is a continuous investigation. This is the practice. If you want to uproot, you have to continually uproot until you're convinced, until you know the truth of it. The first 2,000 times, you may still think it's an aberration. But as you continually look for something, I was saying to somebody, if you want to understand the impermanent nature of phenomena, so-called external phenomena, every object you look at, deconstruct. Over and over and over until you're rid. Because again, take this guy over here. He believes he's Ken. And he believes he's got a self and it's all right.
Shake it up.
All right. because he has how many thought moments and experiences of reinforcing Ken? Hundreds of thousands. It's a deeply ingrained, Now, again, deep insight, meditative insight can go a long way to uprooting that, but it's still, they constantly have to be uprooted. They continually come back because of habit force. And so, over and over and over, right? You don't just, you study the life of the Buddha, right? And we know, historically, he was born in Kapilavastu, and those of us who went to India, we visited these places, right? But we know that if you go to the Buddhist literature, it's like, his career as a bodhisattva, thousands, hundreds of thousands of lifetimes of transformation. and work he did, which is kind of helping us to see, you don't just become a full Buddha, eradicating all. I mean, it's a full Buddha like Shakyamuni, he had no contaminations in his mind. Not a one. He didn't grasp at anything. That's a quite a developed state. The literature that posits all these past lines gives us a sense, but again, you can get up in the morning and look at your garden and see the weeds and go, oh, not again. Or you can be a joyous gardener. That's your job, weeding. And it's a beautiful day and you love to get out there and muck about in the dirt. And so it's the same way you can approach your practice, the same way. You can approach it with weariness and, hard work and overwhelming, oh my God. Or you can go, be joyous. This is my work every day, right? I grasp, I see what's going on, and I cut it. I uproot it. I look, and the sword is the sword of Manjushri. Sword of Manjushri cuts through ignorance. Right. It's like, the Eightfold Wheel, the Eightfold Wheel of the Dharma, that's actually on the currency and the flag of India, the Ashokan Wheel. There you go. And we know that Ashoka took it. King Ashoka, who developed it as a symbol for the Buddha's Eightfold Path, took it from the war chariots because he renounced war. Remember, King Ashoka was a great warrior king, and when he was a warrior king, he did much damage, much violence, and when he actually had his conversion, because he actually visited the countries he had just conquered, and he saw the just devastation, right? I mean, after the great victory. And the victory were prayed, when he actually walked in on the battlefields and just saw the vast devastation, he was just moved to renounce violence. But he used the war chariot, right, as now a symbol of nonviolence. In the same way you'd say, what's a sword wielding bodhisattva doing in the Parthenon of Buddhist bodhisattvas, right? It seems quite because it's a sort of wisdom. It cuts away delusion. That's how you use it. It's not a sword to do harm. It's a sword to end suffering. So the sword that every time you grasp, you look deeply at that grasping. You see the nature of the ego. Self-attachment to phenomena that's behind that grasping, and you just let it go. And if you need to do that once every 20 minutes or once every 5 minutes, it doesn't matter. That's the practice. It's just like that. That's the practice. Right? And you just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. And again, how does it relate to mindfulness and concentration? Well, the mindfulness reveals the grasping. If the light's not on, you can't see what the ego's up to. The mindfulness turns the light on. The concentration means you got your eye on him or her. You're following him around. Right? So mindfulness turns on the light in the room. Concentration means you're following. Right? And then the insight is when the grasping, when the attaching, when the entanglement occurs, you're right there. And you're not there to, hit him or her. You're just there to ungrasp. There's nothing there. There's nothing to be grasped at, and there's no one grasping. And you look deeply into that. If you think there's a grasping, if I was attracted to Ken, even though he's married, and
and I'm in a relationship too, but that was attracted to Kim. Disturbing my meditation or whatever. You know, I would deconstruct it. I would either go, you know, I would look at the eye from which that, whatever is arising, right, and deconstruct that so it would disappear, or I would deconstruct that, which isn't too hard. And either way, I would untangle, right? Is that clear? And over time, it just becomes easier because one understands more deeply the nature of phenomena, the phenomena of self, the phenomena of all other external. Looks like we're getting questions. Yes, you've been, Carol. Yeah, it's kind of tricky.
I can tell that the ego is grasping at it.
Mm-hmm. Fear. Fear of what?
There's a fear of even asking a question.
Because?
Because I expect that you're going to come back with an answer that's going to tell my ego that it really doesn't exist.
I think the best thing is to look at the fear. Because where there is fear, there is attachment. And if a subject matter such as awareness or consciousness or rebirth threatens that, that's a point of practice. And even though it is manifesting sort of in an intellectual, conceptual, right, manner, it's much deeper than that. Mm-hmm. And I would say, go to that place. You know, that is a place of entanglement that is troublesome to us. Again, you know, if this is not dogma or philosophy, the truth has to be found right here. The fear of not existing is worrisome or terrifying to something that believes it exists. If one identifies oneself completely with a self and a body, then annihilation or extinction or ending is scary. But if one doesn't identify with that, identify simply with the awareness of this moment, in this moment, are you aware of me? Are you aware? Let's just say, are you aware in this moment, Carol? Does this awareness that you are aware of now appear to have a beginning, a place where it began?
I'm not aware of that.
What?
I'm not aware of that.
Well, if
you're not aware of it, then you're not aware that it has a beginning. Can you see a place where it ends? No. So what's there to be scared of? If you learn to arrest in this, just as it is, and then you just enjoy the journey. You know, there's a Zen master when somebody said, you know, what happens, what's going to happen to me or what happens to Zen masters after they die? His answer was, why ask me? I'm not dead. come back when I'm dead. And you know, the Buddha also questions like that. He really didn't answer. Because he felt the resolution to these kinds of questions, right, were really in the practice of current awakening. When you establish a ground in awareness that appears to have no end and no beginning, right, and is capable of living through and absorbing all causes and conditions, and continues to be present, that's a safe place to rest. And thoughts of birth and death are simply that. Do we know what happens after death? Some people do, some people don't, some people think this, some people think that. But the bottom line is, yeah, it'd be interesting to find out. Enjoy the journey. Something happens. Just a few more questions. Anything? Yes.
When you were talking about having the relationship with Ken, and you said, well, I would just...
The cadaver.
With that which is known as Ken. And you said, I would just deconstruct it. What would you do? How would you deconstruct it?
Well, for the same way we did earlier. In other words, I see something called Kent, but is there really something self-existent there? Well, there's a body, there's a mind, there's thoughts, there's feelings, perceptions. I mean, you know, it's changing from moment to moment. It was an infant, it was this, it'll be dead. I just would kind of deconstruct the permanence of the seeming thingness of that. Just kind of lay it out in parts, deconstruct it. You know, see it just as a phenomena that has come together and made up of many different kinds of phenomena. It just allows, to see clearly what's going on. But I mean, to me, it is a better practice place because the external phenomena is always changing, right? So I mean, today it could be Ken, tomorrow it'll be Bill. Right? You know what I mean? The next day it'll be Angie, going down the line, right? So, you're endlessly just kind of just working it. Better to work it on this side. What is the source of my yearning, my desire, my grasping? Because when you do that, you're getting at the cause. So while it is a useful exercise to deconstruct and to see the external world of phenomena is also empty, from a practice, from a liberation point of view, it is much more beneficial to do it within one's own, to look at the source. Because, again, as you say, that way, it's a generic awakening and understanding. Well, it's 12 o'clock. We should... Oh, it's after 12 o'clock. So why don't we end here? Non-grasping. Mindfulness, concentration, insight, wisdom. mindfulness lights up the room. Concentration is our capacity to look and follow clearly what which we want to focus on. And the insight comes when we go, aha, I understand now. So everyone here I know, I've met with all of you, I know you all have practices along these lines, variations on a theme. Today is Wednesday, so, you know, things move quickly. Again, you know, wonderful time here. The practice is deep. You're all very sincere and committed. I think you are getting a sense of how to practice. So please don't waste the time. Take this opportunity to look deeply. And again, I think from the teachings we received today, we know that whatever grasping, entanglement, issue, ego state arises, good. Right? Just use everything as an opportunity.